All right, y'all, welcome back to the Fearless Podcast. We are at episode 84, and today I have a really awesome guest, DC from Australia. And I know I always like to do my impersonations, and I'm terrible at it, but DC reached out to us on our YouTube channel. He made a comment, and then I started diving into his story, and it is fascinating. So I asked him to come on the Fearless Podcast. DC, before we get started and you introduce yourself and all that stuff, every guest on the Fearless Podcast gets a gift. Do you drink coffee?
No, I don't.
You're not a coffee drinker. Okay. No. Never mind. Well, then my gift will fall flat. So I usually send somebody out, you know, we have K-cups and whole bean and ground, and I usually send out coffee. But if you don't drink coffee, there's no sense in sending you coffee.
Thanks for the thought, though. Yeah, the thought came.
So, DC, maybe you could introduce yourself and maybe kind of dive into your story. This has been a kind of a long, drawn-out process, and maybe you could kind of bring us up to present day.
Well, present day, that makes a long story, but I'll try and make it as short as possible. Yeah, my name's DC. I go by David C or DC. I originally started a YouTube channel trying to get people to, well, try and show them what I do to manage my disease and try and inspire them not to give up, because I've seen a lot of people give up in the past for small things too recently. And I'm trying to help people to sort of navigate their health as well. Originally, I'm a strength and conditioning coach. I also do breath work and a lot of spiritual stuff now too. Breath work is one of my favorite things to do. So my story starts with, back in 2011, I was living in Japan. I lived there for about 10 years with my wife. She's Japanese. And I lived on the coast of a prefecture called Miyagi. And in March of 2011, we were hit by a 9-magnitude earthquake. And then the tsunami afterwards. You guys probably know about the Fukushima power plant and everything like that, yeah? We lived just north of the power plant where the earthquake actually hit. And so we spent most of that year was obviously surviving, recovering, and trying to rebuild and that sort of stuff, clean up and everything like that. At the end of that year, I decided to come back to Australia, where I live now, to visit my family and spend Christmas with them and just come over for a 2-week holiday. It was really more so to honestly, just to get them off my back, because they were nagging me to go back to Australia. It was but my life was in Japan, so I was determined to sort of keep going with it, my life, my business, my career, my home, everything. So I just come over for a holiday just to show them, look, I'm fine, everything's good. But through that year, I had a lot of niggling problems, I was getting injuries, I was getting sick all the time, I had abdomen pain and things like that. But I thought it was just part of the course. I was getting old. I was 38 and I was slowing down a bit. Yeah. So, looking back, there's a lot of symptoms there. But when I did come back to Australia and I finally got a checkup, because I was sick again when I got off the plane, I did a blood test and the first thing they said was, look, I think you should stay here in Australia to get this sorted out. It was a bit confusing. I was there by myself. My wife was still in Japan. And I said, well, okay, well, what's the problem? He said, well, we're going to need to do some tests, obviously. But it took about 2 weeks all up, and they sent me to a hospital in the city because I was staying at my parents' place. We were out in the countryside, so about 4 hours drive from the city to the hospital. And they admitted me straight away and did another barrage of tests. And they diagnosed me with very high stage 4 follicular lymphoma, a type of blood cancer, with a couple of complications. One of the complications being that I had a large tumor wrapped around my aorta, about the size of a football, and because of the size of it, it was sitting on both of my kidneys. It had decimated my left kidney, and my right kidney was down to just 12% flow capacity. So they gave me at the outside, if I looked after my kidney, you know, 2, maybe 3 months to live, maybe on the outside. And so it was basically a race between the cancer and the kidneys. That's, you know, who was going to kill me first, you know, like, because, yeah, they were neck and neck. And yeah, so my whole world just came crumbling down. You know, I thought I was healthy. My whole life was fitness and so on. And to stay here in Australia and to treat it meant that giving up my whole life in Japan as well, everything that I'd built. You know, luckily I have an amazing wife. So she was on board with me getting it treated, which was, you know, it was really tough. You know, you sort of go through those stages where, you know, you lose everything in a matter of moments. You know, like, it was kind of tough with the earthquake. You know, we lost a fair bit and we lost a lot of work and things like that. But then, you know, we rebuilt and we thought everything was going well. We're going to get back on track. And then everything just got taken away again. And again, just in a matter of, you know, a couple of sentences, like, you've got stage four and, you know, this is the only way you can treat it. This is it. Part of the diagnosis is, you know, with follicular lymphoma, there's no cure. It's inoperable. And it, like, they couldn't even operate on the tumor, even though, like, there were many other tumors. All my lymph nodes were also tumors as well. They were all malignant. So, I mean, it was just everywhere. Multiple kidneys and, multiple organs and other things. But the prognosis is that it's a forever cancer that even if you survive treatment, it will eventually come back. The best you can hope for is a remission period. No one can tell you how long it's going to last, but you will need further treatment for the rest of your life. So basically, you know, that's it. This is as good as it gets, and the rest of your life, you're going to need chemotherapy treatments to manage it. Not, you can't cure it, but you can manage it. So, it's very negative, sort of straight from the outcome. From the start of it, it was all very negative. Like, this is it. This is as good as it gets. And it's only going to get worse from here. And, you know, the kicker is the more we treat it or the more intense the treatment, the shorter the remission periods will be and the more intense the treatment will be. But I'm already stage four, so, you know, I was already starting with a very intense chemotherapy regime. So it was like, there's just no hope of a future. You know, this is the way they sort of bring it across. And, you know, my wife came over to visit me while I'm in the hospital getting this diagnosis. Right before my treatment started, she had to go back to Japan because all she could get off work was 3 weeks. And so she had to go back to Japan and sort of get rid of everything, like get rid of our home and car and my business and everything, just shut it all down. And then she was going to join me in Australia. The problem with that was that I only had the outside maybe 3 months to live, and it was going to take her longer to do that. So we didn't think we'd ever see each other again when she went back. So It was a really tough sort of period, those few months. So I spent that year, I mean, there's a lot of details. There's so much there really to go through. Like, I was now homeless, living in Australia, homeless, and starting chemotherapy. And, you know, my wife's in Japan, and so it was tough. And basically what I was doing, I was just sleeping in the spare room, my parents' place, was about 4 hours from the hospital, and staying on couches at friends' places that were a little bit closer, just trying to recover from treatments and things like that. And then eventually when my wife did come back, we got to stay in a foundation home. It's a leukemia foundation here in Australia. They sort of took care of us for a while. While I'm on treatment, I could stay there with them. So that was really good. But for the first year, I went through what they call R-CHOP. R-CHOP is 5 different regimes of chemotherapy to go through on a 21-day cycle. Now, at the time, I'm thinking, well, there's nothing I can do about it. All the experts are telling me that it's just bad luck. It's got nothing to do with lifestyle or anything like that. It's just genetics, right? So, you know, I gave up thinking, you know, caring about, you know, what I was eating or calories or anything like that. And the hospital would keep bringing around all this lovely junk food for us to, you know, cakes, cookies and soft drinks and just the worst kind of food. You know, all the meals there, I couldn't even eat the meals. They were so bad. Like, they bring around for breakfast, like, pancakes and ice cream and that sort of stuff. All carbs, all sugar. But, you know, like the pancakes looked like they were about 12 months old. I was like, yeah, it's just shocking. Even then, like, I knew they were trying to kill us with the food. I was serious. I just said, look, I can't eat this stuff. You're just going to have to give me something else. Like, so I ended up, you know, just getting meals in from when I could eat. But I ended up doing a lot of fasting, honestly. A lot of fasting afterwards. Because the chemotherapy, like R-CHOP, it leaves, for me, it left me a mouthful of ulcers. My tongue was swollen with ulcers. All my cheeks, like I actually were bloated with ulcers. So I couldn't, like my mouth was open all the time because I couldn't close it because of the ulcers. There's so much swelling. There's an injection you give yourself the next day afterwards and it stimulates your bone marrow to produce more white cells to try and get your immune system working again. But after that, like the bone pain is so intense, like it feels like the weight of your own body is going to shatter the bones, like just lying still, you know. And then there's the like the violent vomiting, you know, and you're vomiting on an empty stomach, and it feels like your skeleton's coming up with it, you know. It's really intense, but. The prognosis for that treatment was 6 to 8 treatments on a 21 days to recover between each one. And I started feeling good about 5 days before the next one for each one.
What was your durations when you were going through all that? What was your duration of fasting? How long did you fast for?
I fasted for the first week afterwards.
Okay.
The whole week. Yeah, and the second week was off and on fasting. It was kind of like when I could eat, I would, but I couldn't really keep much down still in the second week. So it was really just a matter of trying to nibble something, just to put something in the stomach to have something to go up, you know, because it was so much more painful without it. At the time, though, my go-to, another big problem was that the taste of the chemo, like, that's all you can taste. It's so strong. That is all you can taste. You can't taste anything else. And it tastes like you're sucking on like metal. It's horrible. So my go-to at the time was a very strong flavored protein shake that would just, it was easy to get down and easy to bring up. And I was used to that sort of thing too, because you know, I spent a lifetime in the fitness industry. I was on low fat diets, high protein diets all before that. So that's, which was what led to it. But we did that for 8 rounds. It was only meant to do 6, but by the time we got to the 6th one, the chemo hadn't actually done anything for to actually shrink the tumor around my aorta. So it had cleared my blood though. It had cleared my blood, everything was going well, except the tumor just wasn't reacting itself. So we ended up doing the full 8 rounds, and then they had to do targeted radiation, another 18 rounds of radiation on the tumor itself. And I was thinking, like, after this, I've got a bit of a thick skull. You know, like, that. When they told me, like, this is it forever, it's going to keep coming back and all this sort of stuff, like, I'm still thinking, like, just, you know, dose me up, cut it out, let me go home. Like, and I kept thinking, like, after this treatment is done, I'm going back to Japan to start my life again. This is it. I didn't even really take it in that I might be dead in a couple of months. You know, it really didn't settle in. I was just thinking, every time they asked me, you know, what are you going to do after this treatment? I'm like, I'm going back home. I'm going to Japan. I'll get my life back, you know. That's it. That's what I'm doing. After the radiation, they then put me on a 2-year program of what they call rituximab. And rituximab is the first line of the R-CHOP. It's like anagram for R-CHOP, right? And that meant that I had to stay another 2 years, which was a little bit shocking for me at the start. But every 2 months, I'd have to go in and get this rituximab treatment. And every month in between, I have all these other tests, and this is it for the next 2 years. And the goal was of this rituximab was to extend a remission period, because they now put me in a category of stage 2, but stable and in remission. So that continued until January of 2014. I was diagnosed on the It's actually, I entered the hospital on the 4th of January in 2012. I was diagnosed like a complete diagnosis on the 10th. And then in 2014, January 7th, I was very high stage 4 again. Like almost to the day. Like I just finished 2 years of treatment and I was still stage, and I was back to stage 4 again. You can imagine, like, it was very demoralizing. I was somewhat pissed off, actually. And it just being through, it was the R-CHOP and then that 1.5 years. I didn't even make it through the 2 years of rituximab. I mean, that's when it really sunk in that this really is for the rest of my life. There's nothing I can do about it. Like, even up until then, 2 months before, I was still stable on my last test, and I was feeling great. I was actually back in the gym. I went back to the gym about 7 months beforehand, and I started working out again. Everything was going good. And then, like, a month and a half later after my last test, I'm stage 4 again. You can't even tell by how you're feeling, like, what's going on. And so then it was like, they just rushed me straight into a clinical trial because I'd already had basically almost the last line of defense was the R-CHOP, like that's as heavy as you get, and now they needed to try something else. So they got me into a clinical trial for a drug that's called bendamustine, and I was a little bit hesitant because I didn't want to go through R-CHOP again. That was pretty brutal.
Mm-hmm.
But they told me it was much more mild form of chemo. It's supposed to be very effective, but without all the pain and side effects. So I said, okay, well, let's give it a try. It's not like I had much choice. When this clinical trial started, they give you a clinical trial nurse who actually tracks every part of every step of what you're going through. And like, she calls you every day. She makes sure she's there to check everything before you get treated, and every test you get multitudes of tests. So basically, beforehand I felt like a lab rat, and this time it's kind of like feeling like a lab rat in a highly classified program. It's just so tight. But I went through the first treatment and it felt fine going through. R-CHOP, when I went through that, you get these fits. My body started shaking and I couldn't control it, and they had to give you these warm oven blankets to try and calm your body down. But with this one, it was really smooth, so I felt really good. But then I drove home after the treatment, and as soon as I got through the door, I started getting these neutropenic fevers, and I was dizzy. I couldn't stand up properly, I couldn't walk, and I just had to go lie down. I just wanted to sleep it off. But my wife called an ambulance to take me back to the hospital. By the time I got to the hospital, my fever was over 42.5 degrees Celsius. And if I'd slept it off, I wouldn't have woken up the next day. These neutropenic fevers just really almost killed me. So they decided to keep me in hospital for a few days over the treatment to try and keep an eye on my fevers and try and keep bring my fevers down. And they started bringing it down by treating me with a low-grade painkiller and my fluids and things like that. So try and control the fevers. But it just meant that I was neutropenic, and it had shut down my immune system. And that's why I started getting these fevers. So I had to be careful. A small cold or fever, a flu would have killed me. This happened every treatment from then on. So every treatment from then on, I would spend 3-4 days in hospital. After the second one, I started getting blood clots in my arms, my treatment arms, because they were still treating me through the vein. And by the time I got to the fourth treatment, both my arms had filled up with large blood clots from my shoulder all the way down to my wrist. It looked like a 3D roadmap, like you could see mountain ranges. They were so thick and long, which is a bit scary, but they assured me, they're just superficial veins, so they should be okay. But the problem with that is that now both my arms are full, with these clots, so they can't keep treatment. They had to put a port under my chest on the right side and feed it straight into my heart. So, I mean, they just filled up both my arms with these long blood clots, and now they want to feed it directly into my heart. So it was a bit shaky. I'm thinking, you know, like, what's this gonna do? But in the end, it's like, well, I suppose if it's this or the cancer, you know, which one's gonna kill me? It's whatever. You know, there's really wasn't much choice, was it? So we did that. And of course, the treatment went pretty much the same way. The rest of the treatment, did a full 8 rounds of treatment again. But as we scanned it along the way, it had done nothing actually towards the cancer. My cancer just kept growing right through treatment. My tumor kept growing. It just kept spreading. So I did this whole clinical trial, and it did nothing. It nearly killed me a few times, but it did nothing for the cancer. So it's just gone from bad to worse. And so from then, they gave me a couple of weeks off and decided that they needed to do an autonomous stem cell transplant. So that means that they do a stem cell transplant with my own stem cells that they collected back in 2012, once my bloods were clear. This is where I was really lucky, though. I think when they collect my stem cells, they gave me an extra heavy dose of chemo at the time and then gave me a drug to try and stimulate the stem cell production. Like in most people, you know, average, you know, anything over 30% viable is healthy. For a chemo patient, it's around 2-5%. But I'd been doing a lot of fasting. I've always done a lot of lifting, which also stimulates, you know, stem cell growth. When they collected mine, my viable count was 99.4%. So my oncologist couldn't believe it. He had to double check it. So I was really lucky that way. My stem cell count was very strong. But when I came into the stem cell transplant, they had to go particularly heavy dose again because my cancer just kept growing right through that clinical trial. So it was a week straight, 24 hours of chemotherapy, just pumping through 3 different tubes, just going through 24 hours at a time for 7 days. Like, it just absolutely annihilates, like, it kills everything. And on the 8th day, they feed my stem cells back into my body to try and restart everything. It's kind of like a reset button, you know? And they do this by a Hickman line. Now, I had a port on the right side of my chest under my skin, but a Hickman line is 2 tubes stuck in it that go directly into your heart, and they have 2 connectors come out. They actually hang out of your chest with 2 connectors so that they can feed the chemotherapy directly through to your heart. I still have blood clots in my arms too, so they couldn't do anything, feed anything through there. So I had 2 tubes going on that one. I had another one on the other side of my chest for fluids to try and keep my fluids up. About a week after all this started, I got an infection in the tubes, in the Hickman line. So then they had to decide whether to keep it in and keep going or not. I mean, they decided to keep going, of course, but they couldn't do it with the Hickman line, so they had to pull that out. That was kind of a funny story, actually. When they put it in, obviously, you're under, you have an operation, and then you come out, you wake up, and you've got these tubes out. But when they pull it out, like, one nurse just braced my shoulder, another one just yanked it out. It was fairly brutal. And then they just stick a bandage over it and say, "You'd be right.
Rub some dirt on it.
Little Hello Kitty band-aid on top. You'd be right." But it was funny. It was funny at the time. But because I was now, I had this infection, I had an infection in my heart. I went AFib. I was neutropenic. They quarantined my room. No one is allowed in or out except obviously staff, but no one's allowed in or out without. They have to put little booties on, a big, you know, full robe, mask and hat and everything like that. And I was like that for a week. And because of the infection, my heart's, or because of not just the infection, the chemotherapy, it destroys your organs. It really does. It kills the same enzymes that for your organs, cancer enzymes and organ enzymes use the same, on the same frequency, sort of thing. And when the chemo comes in, it just kills everything. So it's destroyed my organs, and my body's so dried out now, it's just, it's incredible. Basically, I was microwaved, you know, I just tell you people, I was microwaved, basically. It cooked everything, it cooked my brain and everything else. And it's from there, like, it was just, it just kept going downhill. It's like, I stopped breathing. I couldn't breathe anymore. It got to the point where the nurse, I stopped breathing that many times over this course. The nurse was coming in every 10 minutes to, every 10 to 20 minutes to check on me, to just to make sure I was breathing. She'd wake me up, you know, through the night, just to make sure that, you know, I'm still there. Because there's a few times where they almost couldn't get me to wake up. But, you know, the worst part was that my wife was sitting in a chair from morning to night next to my bed watching all this happen. That was hard. She'd get up early in the morning. She'd try and prepare some sort of food, something that I might be able to eat. And usually it was only like frozen jelly. Or Jell-O, I think you guys call. And then she'd spend the whole day there with me, just taking care of me, making sure I was all right. A lot of that I wasn't really even awake for, so it was tough on her. I mean, after that, for the next 3 years, she'd wake me up every now and then just to make sure I was still breathing. That's how hard it was on her. It's got a bit annoying, actually. I'm trying to have a nap. You know, in the middle of the night, she'd shake me up, and I'm like, just checking your breathing. But it was tough. You know, as a few times there, a touch and go through the transplant, I almost didn't make it. But the worst part was when I did get out of the hospital about 6 weeks later, because I was so cooked, like, all my tissue was so dry, like my bone tissue, it was really frail. I wasn't producing, after chemotherapy, it really damages your body's, your bone's ability, your marrow's ability to produce platelets and white cells and things like that. So bones are fragile, they're weak, muscles were fragile, they were weak, and they were so tight, they were so dry. Like, just even closing my hand felt like it would break the muscle fibers in my fingers. Like, I couldn't hold a cup. Like, I just couldn't hold it at all. I couldn't move. So I basically went from the hospital bed to my bed, which we'd only just moved to, actually, because, you know, through all this time, we had to find a place to live during this time. We moved to a small studio that was close to the hospital just before the transplant. And like, it was so small, like from my bed to the bathroom and the kitchen was 2 steps, literally 2 steps. And I couldn't even do that after the transplant. I couldn't even get off the bed. I couldn't even sit up on the bed. I was just lying in bed looking at the ceiling for, you know, just waiting for death, basically. My body was just so dried out, and it was painful just to even just turn my head. I was basically frozen when I got home. So, you know, my wife, I had to rely on my wife to do everything, absolutely everything for me. And it's a horrible position to be in. I like to be needed, but I don't want to be needy. I don't want to be dependent on someone else for me to get, like, I couldn't even get something to eat or drink. I couldn't even drink water on myself. Like, my wife was spoon feeding me, basically, when I could eat. It was, yeah, so it took a long time to recover from that, and a lot of it was emotional recovery as well, psychological recovery, but physical recovery was, you know, it was also very long. It took me from there about 2 years before I could actually walk at a pace that I could keep pace with my wife. It took me about 7 months before I was walking with a walker and I could get off the bed by myself. But even then, after that, I was still walking with a walker for a fair bit of time, and I didn't really go anywhere. I put on a lot of weight, and of course, you know, just lying in bed, I was getting fat because eating, but I was just getting fat, of course. I was still on medications too that also make you you retain water and you get moon face and stuff like that. They put me on a lot of steroids right through this whole treatment, right from 2012. So I had this big moon face and I was quite overweight. But, you know, like, part of my recovery was, I think, when I did get out of the hospital, I knew I, as a coach, I needed protein, so I tried to get proteins in. But for the first time, I stopped worrying about being on a low-fat diet and things like that, you know, because that's out of nonsense. And of course, it didn't matter what I really ate at the time anyway, because if you got no future, I mean, bring on the heart attack. You know, mm-hmm. It'd be a lot easier than going through chemo again. So I just started eating a lot of meat, and I literally craved it, you know, for the first time in my life. Like, growing up, I never had much meat on the plate, and my mum wanted us to be vegetarian for, you know, a number of times, and the fitness industry is all about low fat. So I spent a decade eating a chicken breast, mm-hmm. the driest, lowest fat meat I could find, you know, but now I just didn't care. I didn't give a rat's recce. I still had a fat phobia, so I still kind of chose the leaner kind of meat at first. But that's
this. Where I this just happened from like your own natural inclination. It wasn't through any kind of. Was there any kind of research or study that pushed you in that direction, or you felt better when you ate?
I did start doing more afterwards. Research-wise, and I have been for the last 10 years. But I relied too much on what I learned in college, for one, and I relied too much on the trust I had in my doctors and the so-called experts. If I had a question about, I was always trying to get off these medications because I just couldn't handle taking them all. And in fact, from the first lot of treatment, I stopped taking a lot of them because there was just too many. I just couldn't get them down or keep them down anyway. So I figured, what's the point, you know? So I was, after, when I started getting all this, with all these other medications, I kept trying to replace them with something else. There's got to be a natural alternative, surely, or there's got to be something else that can help me with this that doesn't require these expensive medications. So I was always trying to find something. And of course, I was in much worse condition after the transplant. I had an ulcer in my stomach the size of my fist. Yeah, so I had really bad reflux. You know, my esophagus is burning all the time. I was so burnt inside. I was bringing up thick layers of skin from my stomach and my esophagus and my mouth. It was like, after really bad burns, you know, you get layers of skin coming off. But these were like five, you know, about a millimeter thick each time, really thick layers of skin, and I was passing more from my digestive tract, you know. So like this, that's, you know, it's just, and it was, I was red for months afterwards because the heat that was coming out of me and the radiation. Like, my wife, she had to change my clothes and the bed sheets every day and wash them separately. She had to sleep separately, which in a one-bedroom studio, just a little studio, that's very difficult. She slept on the floor at the end of my bed because there's so much radiation coming out of me. If she slept with me or shared the sheets, she'd have a chance of getting radiation poisoning. That's how much was coming out of me, you know. And she did that for a year, afterwards. So that's how much was coming out, you know. And I don't know. I've been writing about this, and from here, I started trying to find ways that I've got to replace these medications, because I've got to find another way to fix these problems, you know, the reflux and stuff like that, because I just couldn't handle it. It was painful, and it was. Yeah, it's just I was just a mess, an absolute mess. And the biggest problem I was having now is like my brain was cooked. And if people think like they've got brain fog on a standard Western diet, you should research chemo fog. You cannot think. Like, I was, my memory problems were so bad, my short term memory loss was so bad that people would actually come and speak with us, my family would come and visit us in the studio after the transplant. 10 minutes later, I completely forgot they were even there. They could spend hours talking to us, and I have no recollection of ever seeing them. Even today, I still can't remember actually seeing them there. Nozomi, my wife, she would tell me about it. I had no concentration skills. I couldn't read anymore. I couldn't speak. I couldn't even piece together a sentence. So I had to basically just point and say, you know, I want this sort of stuff. It was just like a dementia patient. It was basically what it was like. And that's been like ever, and that's the risk of dementia and these sort of diseases after chemotherapy is very high. It's one of those things that has been one of my big fears, actually living like that afterwards, you know. But as things progressed, without even really noticing, I just started eating meat because I was craving it. That's what I wanted to eat. That's all I wanted to eat. I was eating other things eventually. Like I eventually started eating, you know, all the same carbs and stuff I was eating before because it didn't matter, did it? If this is as good as it gets, then who cares what I eat? It didn't matter that I got fat. But from the start, though, the one thing that I did crave was meat. And I didn't understand why at the time, but I felt like, you know, like a dry sponge soaking up water. That's kind of what it felt like, and especially after eating fat. I stopped worrying about, you know, the fat so much, and I was eating real butter and things like that too. So, but this went on for a couple of years, and I was doing a bit of research into, you know, I was trying to find all these different things that would help with different conditions because I had a number of conditions afterwards. I couldn't do a lot of research at the start because my concentration skills, like I was, you know, 10 minutes into it, I was so tired I'd just sleep again. I did sleep a lot, you know, I slept a lot. But as difficult as it was, I did notice it was progressing, like progressively getting better. And a couple of years later, this sort of went on for, and about 2017, mid 2017, I'm walking again. And at the end of that 2017, my wife said, you know, look, we started walking, going regular walks, and I started to lose a bit of weight. So I was about 120 pounds over my weight, my, you know, like healthy weight at the time. And she said, well, how about you start coming back to the gym with me? Okay, yeah, why not? Let's give it a try. You know, I'd been in remission for a few years now, and I was feeling pretty good. We were still living, basically, we were living from there, though. We're still living from blood test to blood test, basically, because you can't plan anything past that when you have follicular lymphoma. You know, there was no point in saying, you know, for example, buying a house and getting a 30-year mortgage if you're only going to be around for 6 months, you know. So everything was just planned 6 months at a time. Or blood test. At first, that was like every week. But at that time, like 2017, it went out to every 6 months. That was our sort of scope of, you know, vision for the future, 6 months from now.
Was that aortic tumor still there?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It was shrinking. It was like in 2017, it was still about the size of a golf ball. So it had shrunk quite a bit. But yeah, by then it was about the size of a golf ball plus some scar tissue. But I was, yeah, apart from that, the blood and everything was still pretty clear. My platelets were always low though. I still have trouble with my blood counts. My blood counts were all very much lower than like the average healthy person. So I still have to be, basically we're living in a bubble. Like everything had to be sterilized, you know, weekly. And if I went out anywhere, we'd come home, wash hands, have showers and change clothes and all that sort of stuff. So it was, you know, I still had to be very careful about colds and flus, which did happen a few times. I had multiple hospital trips because of colds and flus during that period. And you're like, a cold could last me 6 months at that point, you know, because I just couldn't fight it off. I couldn't get rid of it. But when I started going back to the gym, I started, I clean up my diet. You know, get rid of all the sugary carbs and things like that. But I started making the same mistake I did back in the day. Like I started going low fat again. And then I noticed my numbers dropped again. Actually, my numbers after the transplant, I'll just go back a bit. 9 months after my transplant, actually, I had actually started making progress with my bloods. Actually, my blood, my platelets and everything had started to climb. But then they redid all my childhood vaccines and it just collapsed again. It just, all my platelet count, everything, my white cells, my immune system, everything just collapsed again. So I vowed, like, from there, they're never touching me with another needle again. That's it. That's I just, no more trust after that. And I've been fighting ever since to try and build my immune system back up. And I keep trying all these, you know, stupid guru sort of BS about, you know, eat these different herbs and spices, you know, they kill cancer, they build your immune system and all this. So I tried everything, you know. I even tried, I tried everything, honestly. I looked into everything that would, they keep saying, oh, these berries have antioxidants, they'll kill cancers and all this sort of stuff. And these, you know, turmeric and all this other things. And none of it even made you feel good. Like, it was absolute nonsense, you know. And I was trying the purest form of all these foods that I could find. But in the end, like, when I did go back to the gym and I noticed that when I went low fat again and I went low carb, I know low carb's good because you get lean, you know, but that was all about, you know, calories for me at the time. As a coach, you know, as long as you've, you know, got a calorie deficit, it's all good. But they don't tell you anything about micros rather than macros. But anyway, I made a mistake of going low fat again. And I noticed that my bloods, because for the first time I was monitoring my bloods basically every month. And it just got worse and worse. And I was getting sicker and sicker again. So I said, well, okay, there's got to be something. There's got to be something wrong here. You know? And I'll say this now because it doesn't matter what diet you're on. I'm not loyal to any diet. I think if you are on any kind of diet and you still get sick, then you have to rethink what you believe. And for me, that was a real turning point too, when I thinking about low fat. So I basically just went back to eating as much meat as I could, and I didn't care about red meat anymore. I much prefer the red meat because I stopped eating the chicken breasts so much. And, you know, I was basically a ketogenic diet. I was eating so-called healthy veggies and rice and that sort of stuff. And I was doing okay. You know, I was doing pretty well. The numbers started to climb up slowly. I was losing fat. I was training hard in the gym. And eventually my wife actually came across the carnivore diet. She said that there's this young guy in Japan who only eats meat. And she says, that's it. He doesn't eat any veggies or rice or anything like that. Just meat. And I immediately thought, BS, that's ridiculous. That is absolute nonsense. Like, there's a difference between, you know, bad carbs and healthy carbs and all this. The old coach mentality, you know. And I'm thinking, what kind of nutcase just only eats meat? You know, what about fiber? And then I thought, okay. Well, I figured I'd have a look at it. And then I found Sean Baker. And I thought, well, he's doing pretty well. He's looking, I mean, he's fit, he's strong, you know. He's training pretty hard. Maybe there's something to it. Maybe there is. So I started looking more into the carnivore diet. And when I realized that it's not about the protein so much as it's more about the fat, I found Professor Thomas Seyfried. He's talking about ketogenics, fasting, and cancer. That's when it started making sense. It all sort of came together then, you know. And I'm thinking, okay.
And what year was that, DC?
So that was, this was a very slow progression actually for me. This was only 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago now.
Okay. Okay.
So basically from 2018 to 2022, I was on a moderate fat ketogenic diet. And I was doing okay. I wasn't doing great, but I was still alive and I wasn't needing any treatment. And I was down to just two medications. So I'd sort of wean myself down. I'd found different things that would help, things like that would help my IBS, which was really one of the biggest thing. Like, because at one stage there, I was going to the toilet like 8 times a day. So I found sauerkraut. You know, sauerkraut is fantastic for IBS and for gut health and things like that. But I think largely because it's fermented in salt. You know, you don't get much out of cabbage. You know? You don't get anything real unless you ferment it anyway. But the salt, the fact that it's fermented in salt, I think has a real benefit for your stomach and for many other processes. And from there, like I went from 8 times a day down to 1, just by adding sauerkraut. And the reflux and things like that, the sauerkraut also helped for the reflux. But I also had a medication for that. I was held on maximum medication for that for years, actually. But when I started increasing my fat intake and reducing my fiber intake, the reflux just went away anyway. So, like, I'm on 0 medications now since carnivore.
Awesome. Yeah.
You know, like, it's amazing the difference. Like, I mean, I won't go into all the ridiculous advice you get from hospital because that's just, that'll take, you know, 10 days. When I found these guys and I figured, okay, what I should have been doing was reducing everything. So I basically, from 2018, I basically put myself on a caveman diet, like a caveman version of keto. Fruits and that sort of stuff, like I would eat occasionally, like, I tried to only eat seasonal sort of fruits. It wasn't every day. And if I felt like something sweet, like a dessert, then it would be fruit. But at the time, I didn't really know enough about the liver and, you know, fatty liver disease and that sort of stuff. So things changed a lot. But 2.5 years ago now, I just eliminated the rest of it and I just went straight carnivore. And through that period, I gradually ate more and more animal fats. I was eating more butter. I was eating more. I didn't worry about cutting the fat off the steak. And I started getting, you know, the fattier cuts as well, because they were actually cheaper here in Australia too. The fattier it is, the cheaper it was to buy it. So that really helped. You know, I was on disability pension, so I couldn't really afford a lot of, you know, great quality meat here. But as it worked out, that was, you know, healthier for me anyway.
Mm-hmm.
When I went full carnivore, I was amazed at the difference in, like, I think like keto is like 90% there, but that extra 10% is like night and day, you know?
Yeah.
I still had a lot of brain fog, but it was getting better. It was improving, you know, slowly. But I was able to sit and have a conversation again on the keto diet. I could piece together sentences and I could read again, I even analyze research and stuff again. But when I went carnivore, it's like so much more just cleared up for me. I no longer have any medications for my reflux or IBS. I don't even take sauerkraut anymore, unless, you know, sometimes I just like it. But I don't need it for my IBS anymore. I still have a few things, like I still have other lifestyle things that help a lot as well. It wasn't just that. When I did get out of the, like about a year after I did the transplant, another thing I started doing was breath work. Because at first, I couldn't breathe. I was so seized up, like, all the muscles around my chest and my stomach and everything was so seized up. All I could do was shallow breathe. So I started doing some breath work. I found, like, just looking on YouTube, you know, Wim Hof.
Mm-hmm.
And I started with that. Of course, I couldn't do that basic. I just sort of broke it down and did what I could, you know. And eventually it got better and better. And now I've been doing that for 9 years. So, you know, I love doing breath work. It has so many benefits. So I think those are my top two sort of hacks, actually, the carnivore diet, like a high-fat carnivore diet and breath work. And since then, I've accrued it, like I've gathered a few other sort of life hacks that really help as well. But at the time, it was just breath work and carnivore. And from there, like, it's hard to explain just how much better I felt mentally, but also emotionally as well. I find that I handle a lot more, a lot easier now. I mean, I've been through some pretty stressful times the last 12 years, but it's, you know, it's, I don't know. I just feel better about it. It doesn't bother me so much anymore. You know, like, I'm 51. I'll be 52 in a couple of years. Sorry, in a couple of months, a couple of years. Yeah, a couple more months, I'll be 52. And I'm just sort of just starting to get my, I'm just getting my life back together. Not an ideal position to be in, but Yeah, I'm positive about it, and I'm feeling pretty good. After the earthquake, I saw so many people, you know, took their lives, and that kind of affected me. My sister took her own life too, back in 2005, and in January. It's just something that I don't. It's not something. I mean, I have thought, like, going through everything I went through. I thought about it. But not to the point where I actually plan, okay, this is how I'm going to do it sort of thing. It was more like, you know, I would argue with myself saying, what are you doing? Like, are you going to die or not? Just do it. You know? If I'm going to die, just bring it on. Why torture me by dragging it out? You know? I would literally argue with myself and say, look, either crap or get off the pot. It was depressing some days to just wake up, you know, as like facing another day of this, staring at the ceiling above my bed. It was like, why do I want to keep doing this? Why are you still here? But it wasn't something I was going to do myself. It's like, how much more can you do? How much more can you take? But in the end, it was like, well, I don't know. Let's try and find out.
So what's your current prognosis when it comes to the follicular lymphoma as far as like your numbers, and have they declared you in any type of stage, or are they declaring you in full remission? Or
I'm in full remission. I have been now since October last year. Is 10 years since I left the hospital, and like every October is kind of an anniversary for me, and so is January, because January is, you know, the 2012 is when I was diagnosed the first time. January 2014 I was diagnosed the second time, so January is another sort of milestone for me as well. And like for me at the moment, I'm in full remission. Now my bloods fluctuate. I've noticed that when like I do days where I do more of my routines, or before each test, the more regular I am with my routines that I do, my life hacks, the higher my blood counts are. But sometimes I will neglect them. No one's perfect, you know. But sometimes if I neglect them, like leading up to a blood test, they might be quite low. But in the end, at the end of the day, I'm stable.
Are you still getting tests, blood tests every 6 months?
I have blood tests every 3 months.
3 months, okay.
Yeah, but I now visit my oncologist every 9 months. He just put that out last year. He put that out to 9 months, so that was good. But I'm a lot more confident now that I can manage this, that I am stable enough now that I can sort of get on with my life. I can start making long-term plans, and that's what I've been doing the last couple of years too. So and I think like when I have a couple of things that most of what I do actually you can do in like 20 minutes in the morning, you know, so it's really not that complicated, not that hard to do. So I think it's very manageable now. And yeah, now I'm trying to, like I said before, I'm trying to get my life back together. You know, it's kind of difficult at the moment. Look at the way, you know, the country's being run here in Australia. It's a little bit crazy at the moment. But I'm very positive about it, though. I think everything's going to work out. And I'm thinking about it's going to start coaching people again. But now I have, with all this experience, I have a lot more ammunition, should I say. A lot more ways that I can, a lot more avenues where I can help other people. Yeah, and that's my goal, is to help as many people as I can now with their journey, whether it be cancer, weight loss, health, or just health in general, you know. So
that's great. That's awesome. So, you know, before we wrap up, where can everybody find your information, DC?
Yeah, you can catch me on YouTube or Instagram, X, Twitter, and Facebook.
Okay.
DC Learning to Live, or like at the moment, it's just my YouTube is just David C, you know, like Journey Back to Health and Life. So because it's not just about health, it's also about the spiritual side of things, you know, how to get your life back in or get yourself into the emotional state where you can start living again, you know, because I think a lot of people take tough situations really hard and they blame themselves a lot and they think there's no way out. But I think, like, it's really about, you know, envy has a lot to do with that as well. I think they look at other people and what they have and they think, well, you know, it makes them feel worse for some reason. Like, I think we're all just here learning to live the best we can, and that's why I call it learning to live, because that's, we're all just learning as we go. No one's an expert on life, you know. So you just take it one day as you can, do what you can at the time, and what you can do will get better, you know.
Well, your story is incredibly encouraging from what you've been able, from what you've went through and what you've been able to, just the fact that you're still alive. And now, 10 years removed, you're not only alive, you're starting to thrive and rebuild. And simultaneously, you are also at this age that supposedly, you know, once you hit your 50s, you're in decline, you know, and you're actually, not only are you not declining, you're continuing to improve and feel better. And you want to share, you know, everything that you've learned. And that's usually the main reason for why the most of the things that, you know, God puts us through is that we can learn from it and help others. So your story is incredible. It's fascinating. I will link your YouTube channel down below. And man, I really, it's very inspiring. We have a very close friend that's going through cancer stuff right now, and she's a fighter and she's fighting the good fight, and I'm sure she'll be encouraged by your message. And yeah, I really appreciate what you're doing. Anything that we can help you to, you know, promote whatever you're doing or whatever your next steps are, whatever you're planning to do, you know, let me know, and we gladly want to help you do that.
Well, that's great, man. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. All the best of luck to your friend. I mean, it's very daunting when you're diagnosed. You know, a lot of people see it as a death sentence, and that, like, it, you give up and you think that's it. But it's really not true. I mean, I was the same, especially, well, the second time I was anyway. There are ways that you can fight it. I think a lot of the time too, when doctors tell you that, like, they tell you that there's nothing you can do about it, it's because they just haven't seen it done yet. And they think that this is the only way. The biggest problem I find with these, the way people look at it like that, is because they take control from you. So you basically, you're just along for the ride. That's not true. You know, there is something you can do about it. I believe you can always improve. If you have the right lifestyle changes and dietary changes, there are things that you can do to make even the worst situation make even just a little bit better.
What's your oncologist think right now about your crazy diet and everything you're doing?
Actually, he's on board with the diet. He's not okay, bad. Good. He's a pretty good guy. But he thinks I'm a machine. He can't believe what I've gone through. Like, he thought I was dead through the transplant, so he didn't think I was going to survive the transplant or very long afterwards. So he can't believe the difference between then and now either. But diet wise, he's on board with it, actually. Yeah, so that's all good.
Well, that's awesome.
You can't argue with the results.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, that's my whole thing. When I recommend the carnivore diet, I was like, try it for 30 days. And it's a self-righting mechanism, because as you get that question all the time, oh, how do you stay away from the carbs, and how do you not cheat, and or how do you not? And it just comes down to feeling good and feeling healthy and getting sleep and feeling well and being able to function at a high level feels so much better than any ultra processed baked goods or ultra processed ice cream or anything that I could temporarily enjoy for 5 minutes. You know, it's part of the ramifications of eating highly processed foods is it's part of the blessing, because when I eat something that I know I should not eat, I immediately suffer the consequences of it. And it's just like, wow, I immediately, all my inflammation comes back and I start to hurt, and I'm like, that is so dumb. So you really, it's really like your body's training yourself, you know what I mean? And your body's like, don't do
it's
that.
Like a hangover.
Yeah, unless you want to feel like junk.
Hangover.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. And this has been an awesome discussion. Probably have you back on again. It's your time. Thanks for coming on. And this has been great. I will link David's information down below. Go over and subscribe to his channel. He's got some awesome information over there. Thank you so much, David, for your time. We appreciate y'all. And thanks for listening, y'all. We'll see you on the next show.